It's Sam Cedar launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, June 7th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. We are live from Netroot Nations 2012 from the conference room of Netroots Nation. I've got it together, folks. It took me a little while. It wasn't easy today. And joining me with our first of many guests that we anticipate on today's program, it's a real pleasure, Adam Green from PCC. What is the PCC? What is the PCC, Adam?
It's actually three C's, the Progressive Change Campaign Committee.
What did I call it, PCC?
It's okay, boldprogressives.org. Uh-huh. We're about a 3.5-year-old organization now. Almost a million members strong, and we do a combination of helping to support bold, progressive candidates like Elizabeth Warren and doing issue advocacy for actual progressive legislation and ideas.
Okay.
We're the backbone. We try to be the backbone of the Democratic Party, pushing in a more progressive direction.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that. Cheer me up, because I feel like maybe the Democratic Party isn't moving in a less progressive direction. Or maybe it's always been there. Maybe it's just more clear in the context of them being sitting in a position of governance. But cheer me up, because I'm not feeling very well about it.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it's okay to acknowledge on the front end that it's okay to feel bad. That, you know, we live in a very broken democracy right now, where corporate money really pervades both parties. You know, Republicans more so than Democrats, but Democrats as well. Even among people that aren't completely bought off, there's a lot of risk aversion and unwillingness to actually be bold. And the majority of the country is progressive on every economic issue of the day. It's almost 80-20, you know, protecting Medicare, protecting Social Security, taxing the rich, even stuff that you don't usually hear about talking to the media, like a full employment act, you know, putting people to work, things like that. The country supports. And what we need are progressive ideas and progressive, you know, leaders who are willing to barnstorm the country, campaign on those ideas, make the case, and rally the people to their side. We need some more Paul Wellstone-type figures.
Can we get those in an environment where the leadership, and you know, whether I'm talking about President Obama or I'm talking about Nancy Pelosi coming out for $1 million tax cuts as opposed to, excuse me, extending tax cuts on people who make $1 million or more, or it's not even that. It's extending tax cuts for every dollar made over $1 million as opposed to over $250,000.
Right.
Can you have candidates, can a Paul Wellstone emerge when that oxygen is being sort of sucked out of the room by the leadership?
They can emerge, but I think we shouldn't be under any illusion that, like, 2013 will be our year. You know, if we're lucky, we'll...
You don't think we're going to have a big comeback in the late stages of 2012?
I mean, there might be a comeback for Democrats. That's possible. But for progressives, even if we take back the House majority, like, we don't have a genuinely progressive president right now. We have a current state of the Democratic Party Democratic president right now. Much better than a Republican, but not where we need to be. If Elizabeth Warren gets elected to the Senate, if we elect a couple bold progressives to the House, that's a down payment on the type of future that we want. And honestly, you know, the way our organization thinks about our long-term theory of change, you know, I'd be very depressed personally entering Congress in this environment. It would kill me to have to be there. But for those good
people... So are you officially announcing that you will not be a candidate this
year? I will not be a candidate for Congress this year. But by process of elimination, you can now tell who the next Congress will be. But, you know, of those good people who are willing to run, we need to support them. That's what our organization does. We typically, you know, through $3, $5 contributions at boldprogressives.org, raise hundreds of thousands of dollars for candidates. We've raised, I think, about $800,000 for Elizabeth Warren so far. And, you know, them getting in there is a good step towards success. But we need to change the system. We need fundamental campaign finance reform. You know, our friend Cenk Uygur talks about this all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, no matter what our issue is that we care about, whether it's the environment, whether it's healthcare, whether it's taxes, none of our agendas will move forward if politicians can be so easily bought. We need public financing of elections, and we need to overturn Citizens United. So we have to work on multiple fronts to both change the system and elect some good people within the current system.
Let me ask you, because I think one of the themes I'm going to be talking about with just about everybody I speak to at this conference, convince me why people should continue to engage in electoral politics as opposed to action that is more protest-oriented.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's either or. Well, I thought about this issue a lot lately, and I think it's a totally legitimate question to ask. You know, my argument would be, do not just go along with the Democratic Party. I don't think we have to just accept, you know, lesser evilism. Find the genuinely progressive candidates and put your marbles there. So that's what we do. I mean, we will probably invest in 6 to 12 races this cycle. And there's a lot of Democrats that, you know, good luck to them, but they're not bold progressives. We're not going to support them. And they're, thanks to the internet, people can now find those people easily online. A lot of them are on our website, Bold Progressives. We can make phone calls via our computer into their districts targeting key voters and help those people get elected. But I would totally see the point that that's not sufficient. We need to do more. And that's why, you know, direct protests of corporations, direct protests of, you know, the establishment as it is, you know, we're getting more and more into corporate campaigning, as well as state-level work, honestly, which is where we actually have a fighting chance of success in the short term. Mm-hmm. So we need to be willing to engage in a multi-front war. But, you know, somebody who says, I'm a bold progressive, and my only priority this year is to elect Barack Obama, you know, I think that they need to expand their horizons a little bit. Because, again, 2013 won't be our year, but we need some down payments on success.
Okay, one more question. I appreciate your time because I know you got to run.
Yeah.
How has Netroots, I mean, you've obviously, we've been going to this since it was Yearly Co's.
Yeah.
How has it changed in your mind within the context of the conversation we just had?
Okay, well, just one historical note. Here's one thing how it hasn't changed. The very first Yearly Co's, my very first panel, was with you. I don't know if you remember this. This is actually how I met you. We were on a panel together. It was an awesome panel. I don't remember the topic, but people loved it. It was great.
I don't remember that.
So that's one
time. I didn't even remember I did a panel.
Yeah.
All right, but I believe you.
So how have things changed? Look, we have seen, you know, we're increasingly moving to a bottom-up culture, right? Top-down institutions are falling. If they were a stock, they have a downward trajectory. The typical party committees are powerful, but on the decline. The old school institutions. And those that truly are bottom up are on the rise. And what we've seen is that, you know, blogging has gone from something that was seen as kind of, you know, fringe and weird to something that is very acceptable in mainstream. We've seen, really in the last couple of years, an influx of organizations where people were like, you know what, there's a gap in our infrastructure, in the way we organize as progressives. I'm not going to ask the big institutions to fill that gap. I'm going to do it myself. And, you know, myself and Stephanie Taylor, we did that in terms of supporting progressive candidates. There's a new group, Ultraviolet, that is supporting women. Color of Change, after Katrina, was like, wow, we need more online advocacy for black people. And they have nearly a million members strong. And they've been leading the charge against ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is, you know, the voter suppression union-busting organization that's been around for decades, but only this year has finally gotten exposed and defunded thanks to great campaigning. So, you know, we're organized. And what people have to recognize is that the Netroots aren't a bunch of kids, aren't a bunch of unsophisticated thinkers. It's actually a lot of really talented people who have been around the block, recognize that there are flaws in the current system, and have decided to take their talents to a new place, including, you know, former campaign managers, people in their 40s and 50s who have been involved in politics for 20 years and said, whoa, we need a new movement. So this is really the embodiment. I think this is like the freshest conference out there. It's where progressives come to think together and plan together and organize together, not just, you know, eat fancy lunches and drink cocktails. I mean, it's a really important chance to see our fellow people.
And of course,
and Sam Cedar is
I'm sitting here with a huge cocktail in front of me right now.
There actually was a Red Bull here before. Where's the Red Bull? Okay.
Adam Green from the PCCC.
BoldProgressives.org.
BoldProgressives.org.
And thank you, Sam, seriously, for being such a fresh voice out there. I just really appreciate it.
Thank you for being fresh.
All right,
appreciate
take care.
It. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back in a moment with Pat Garofalo.
Hi, this episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Majority Report listeners can get a free audiobook download at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Pick up James Galbraith's The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. That's at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. You can support the show and get a free audiobook. Do it now. audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Sam Cedar on The Majority Report. And sitting with me, it is a pleasure to welcome to the show Pat Garofalo from the Center for American Progress. Right? Or is it Think Progress?
Think Progress, which is part of the Center for American Progress.
Yeah, I know. It's the blog. I don't know how you guys like to ID yourselves.
Think Progress. ThinkProgress.org.
Pat, it is a pleasure to be finally talking to you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Give me a sense of, is this your first time at, this is not your first time at Netroots Nation?
No, this is my third.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
I've been 4 years in this job, man.
Wow, have you?
Yeah.
You gotta be kidding me.
That's why they call me editor now.
Congratulations. Are you editor of the,
I am editor of the economics section.
So, how screwed are we?
Moderately. As the last jobs report showed, a little bit.
Right. I mean, but do we have, aside from the fact that we've been essentially in a, what could be described as a period of austerity.
That could be, is.
Right.
Austerity light. Yeah.
Austerity light. Where we've seen 600,000 public sector workers, 600,000 plus over the past 3 years now.
It's actually been the worst 3 years for public employment in American history.
Which is probably the worst time for that to be the case.
This is actually the first time we have ever cut public sector jobs during a recession.
And it's not working out too well, is it?
It's terrible, and it doesn't make any sense to be firing that many people and then the ripple effect that happens when you lay off that many. And it's because at the federal level we're not willing to support public projects, and then because we're not providing aid to the states, that's actually where the pain is happening. So they were talking about state and local governments firing teachers, firing firefighters.
And they're having to do this because of diminished revenues as a function of property values plummeting, sales, consumer demand slacking.
Medicaid bills going up, and because the federal government isn't supporting them in the way that it can.
What are the different mechanisms in which that's happening? So Medicaid obviously is not covering, is footing the bill. There are unemployment benefits that states have to pay for. What about that Build America Bonds program? Do you know anything about that?
I know a little bit, and it helped a little bit on the margins. But it's kind of like many things we've done to address the recession. It was kind of a roundabout way of accomplishing what we should be doing, which is just investing in infrastructure.
Right.
The federal government can simply start projects and invest in infrastructure. Instead, we kind of did this circular, letting the states have these bonds that are relatively cheap in order for them to invest instead of just doing it.
Everything's
straight.
A bank shot.
That's exactly right.
I mean, that whole stimulus in a large respect was a bank shot, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
In fact, maybe a double bank shot. Like it bounces off of one backboard and then hits another backboard and then hits another backboard and then gets into the hoop to the extent that it does.
Right, and including things that they knew weren't going to work, but in order to get a couple of Republicans on board, in order to make it look bipartisan, they clunked in all of these tax cuts that, if you look at the numbers, we knew weren't going to work.
Is that your sense of what it's been about? Is it really been all transactional in that regard? Or has it been that the starting point from an ideological perspective has also has been a little bit of that ilk? In other words, is it just a function of, like, we need to bring these people on board, we need to tack this far to the right or make it so much of a bank shot? Or is it that they also started in many respects from a starting point that ideologically was already believing in a bank shot? I mean, the thing that resonates in my mind is President Obama saying during the 2008 campaign, you know, I would have been for single payer, but it's just not American, or it doesn't, you know, American values. And now I realize
saying early on, we need to tighten our belts. Families are doing it, so the government has to do it too, which is exactly wrong.
Yeah, okay. So what of that? I mean,
I think it's hard to separate the politics from the policy when it came to addressing the recession. If you look at the first memo that Christina Romer, formerly on the Council of Economic Advisors, put out, she wanted the $1.2 trillion.
Right.
So it immediately, for political reasons, it got pared back. So I think it's hard to tell what they believed would actually work or whether they were going for the kind of politics angle,
I mean,
and it couldn't pass.
Do you think it's purely political reasons? Do you think it was pure? That's my point. Do you think that the reason why I got pared back was purely political reasons, in the sense that, like, we can't get this to fly because people are going to say you're spending $1 trillion, which, of course, is what they say now anyways.
Right.
Nobody says, like, who's on 770
billion? It was kind of traditional Obama, where it was moving the goalposts before you even started negotiating, whereas instead of coming out with your strongest position and then starting to negotiate, he says, oh, well, we're not going to get it, so let's just move the goalposts before we even start the negotiations.
But do you think there's also been reporting to the effect that there was an awareness like, okay, we can come back if it needs to be more, but the point is they're going to err, put aside the supposed political story. And by political, I'm just talking like strictly how can we message this and all that. The inclination to err on the side of less stimulus, because, of course, this could put pressure on raising taxes, or it could just simply show the efficacy of government. Is it not possible that it also just sort of the starting point, like that there was also that element of it, that it wasn't just about what will sell politically, but rather ideologically speaking, we have an aversion to going big here?
It could have been. I mean, I think it's really hard to untangle the different things that were going on. And depending on who was the different people in that room, I think would tell you different stories. I think if you talked to Romer, she would say, yeah, it was political. But maybe if you talked to Summers or Ortzag, they would tell you something different.
Right. That's a good point. So tell me, what else? You know, you cover just about anything that comes down the pike in terms of economics. And I know you've been following the mortgage fraud and whatnot. Give me your sense of I spoke to David Dan, who I'll be running the interview a little bit later, either today or tomorrow. But give me your sense. Eric Schneiderman is making the keynote talk tonight here at Netroots Nation. Give me your sense of how that's going.
Poorly. I think the most underreported story, and we've been trying to get it as much coverage as we can right now, is the fact that states are taking the money from the $25 billion foreclosure settlement, the money that was earmarked specifically to help people who are underwater, to help people who are foreclosed upon illegally. They're taking that money and using it for other budget purposes. They're filling budget gaps. Scott Walker balanced his budget with it. Governor Chris Christie is balancing his budget with it.
There are Democrats, too.
Maryland did it. Vermont did it. Right. So we're running the gamut from deep blue to deep red states. And that was money that was specifically meant to help a specific
group
of people.
Now, it wasn't $25 billion in actual cash payments. It was closer to like five or six, yeah?
Right, yeah. So the way the settlement was broken down was the bulk of the money was just used by the banks to help homeowners directly, direct payments, mortgage refis, but a portion of it was given to the states to design their own foreclosure prevention programs, and that's the money that's getting siphoned off for all sorts of stuff, and some of which is legitimate uses. They want to plug education budgets.
Right. But Missouri, I think, is doing
that. Yeah, but that's taking money away from homeowners who desperately need it.
Now, but this was not only anticipatable, if that's a word, but it was, in fact, anticipated.
Yes.
I mean, people were talking about this. I specifically remember this because I think I was filling in for Olbermann when this was announced, and we were talking that day that, well, this money's not going to end up there because it's not required to. There just seems to be almost it almost seems like it's gone beyond sort of neglect to sort of almost an animosity to people who have been victims of this.
Now they don't want it to look like they're bailing out people who don't deserve it. And I mean, we're talking about bank shots. I think the biggest failure of the Obama administration has been the complete flop of their foreclosure prevention programs. The Home Affordable Modification Program, which is supposed to be this huge deal that was going to help 4 million people, hasn't yet helped a million. The money's just literally sitting around in a bank account somewhere.
Why?
Because the way they designed it was counting on the banks to, through incentives, do this on their own.
Right.
And they don't have an interest in doing it. You have to do it directly. The banks just, it's not in their financial or, honestly, technical interest to sit around and modify all these mortgages. But the administration counted on them to do it and said, hey, we'll leave this pot of money, and as you get around to it, you can take from this pot of money. And the money is literally sitting in a bank account somewhere, unused, billions of dollars to help homeowners.
Just don't get it with these. Again, it seems to me that...
And can you imagine the difference if you had 4 million people who, instead of sinking their entire paychecks into their mortgage every month or walking away, had that money to spend on other things? And the ripple effect that would have through the economy. They go, instead of sinking their money into that, they go down to the mall and are able to buy whatever it is they need, and that just, the stimulus effect, it compounds itself.
I mean, surely there must be somebody in the White House right now going, you know, we really need to stimulate the economy. We can't get this bill passed. We can't get our $50 billion America Jobs bill passed, whatever it is. It would be really great to give the economy a shot in the arm. Hey, I know. We got all that money sitting in the... I don't understand.
And they've run out a few technical fixes, and it just hasn't done the job. I think they're terrified of the impression that they're bailing out homeowners who don't deserve it.
That's really what it is. I mean, it's that guy Santelli standing up on CNBC.
Absolutely.
That's still resonating.
Yes.
And for people who don't remember, that's when the business reporter, right? Of CNBC.
He's the CNBC stock guy. He's always on the floor of the exchange yelling.
Who asked the Chicago guys, like, hey, do you want to bail out guys who get a bad mortgage?
I mean, it's the myth that the housing crisis was caused by people who bought more house than they could afford rather than this systemic predatory lending that came from Wall Street.
And the securitization of those crappy loans time and time and time again, multiple times over. So basically you're just taking...
So that now when you try and find who you're actually supposed to be paying your mortgage payments to, you can't even find them because the banks don't know themselves where these things are.
Right. I mean, you basically took a cat poop and somehow multiplied it so many times that it comes out to be basically elephant poop. That's right. I mean, is that right? Like, they just kept going, like, we're going to securitize this once, and we're going to bring it from cat poop to dog poop, and then we're going to securitize it again. We're going to bring it from dog poop to goat poop. Oh, no, or well, I don't know.
Now you have banks foreclosing on homes they don't even own.
Right. Well, that's fantastic. Folks, if you want to read more of Pat Garofalo's writing and reporting, you do both, sort of, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
At thinkprogress.org. Is there a /?
/economy.
/economy. All right. Pat, thank you so much for joining us on the program. All right, folks. So just to catch up where we are, it is sorry for the late start today. I am at Netroots Nations 2012. I am sitting in Radio Row across from various radio and internet radio luminaries. Been here since yesterday, and intend to hopefully talk to a bunch more people. I have an interview that I recorded a little bit earlier with David Dayan. I'm going to run it now, and we'll see. I might be able to take some IMs and some phone calls as the show continues. And give me 1 second. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to be playing that David Dayan interview. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I lied to you. I will bring you that David Dayan interview a little bit later, but ran into Tim Pool, who is wandering around here not carrying a video camera. Awkward.
Yeah, I am.
Of course. Oh, yes. Sorry about that, folks. Is that where you shoot now from?
Yeah.
Well, Tim Pool. Here, Tim, come up a little bit closer to the microphone. Tim Pool, of course, of TimCast. Is it TimCast.com?
That's TV.
That's what?
Dot TV. TV.
And Tim, we've spoken to on the Majority Report, one of the first or at least most well-known live streamers of Occupy. Well, mostly Occupy New York, but you were in Chicago and...
Yeah, I did NATO. I've done Trayvon Martin rally. I was in Montreal just last week. So,
oh, you were?
Yeah, after Occupy, I was like, hey, you know, I went around to all these places to see, to cover everything, I guess.
Okay. I want to talk about Montreal in a second, but first... one of the interesting things is to sort of see some Occupy presence here at Netroots,
yeah.
At least on the panels.
My panel got bumped.
Your panel got bumped? What does that mean?
It didn't get approved.
Oh, well, yeah, no, that happens all the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's big, they get like offers of 7-10 more, you know, times panels that. But there are panels here about Occupy, and there are people from the Occupy movement. Have you ever been to Netroots before?
Nope.
Okay. So why did you come here?
Well, I got asked to be on a panel about drones, but it didn't get approved. So I actually had set up plans to come. And then I talked to a few journalists, and they assured me that I should still come because it's an important thing to be at. So I decided to come. And
had you heard of it before?
Nope.
It's interesting.
Yeah, it is to me, because apparently I should have. And my friends are like, Netroots, oh, man, that's amazing.
Oh, so the people, so it's not, within the context of sort of the Occupy people you know or broader circles, there was an awareness of this. I'm just curious as to sort of how disparate sort of these worlds are. You know, of course, you know, Jesse LaGreca was down at Zuccotti Park very early, and he had been on Daily Kos for quite, you know, a long time. So there is definitely crossover. I'm just curious.
I hadn't heard of it, and I don't hang out with a lot of the Occupy people. I have friends from down there, but I try to be neutral. I don't really Yeah, so
from a journalistic perspective.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I never thought about it as being a journalist and being neutral from my life. I always just really wanted to observe and understand before making judgments. So that kind of transferred over and brought me to where I am.
From your perspective, how has Occupy evolved?
I mean, the first 2 months, it was huge. It was this big, extremely visible. There was physical occupations, and there still are. Now it's more of an idea that people, I don't know how to describe the idea because it's so broad, but it's, you hear about, you know, Occupy the Homes, Occupy Climate Change, Occupy the SEC. It's an idea of people coming together to basically put their foot down and, you know, make a demand. It's hard to say make a demand, but it's like focusing on occupying this particular topic as a point of change. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And now I want to ask you about Montreal. Well, what did you observe up there?
Wow. That's all I got to say about Montreal. Most, you know, almost everyone was protesting. I went up there, and I was really careful because
what do you mean almost everyone was almost everyone in the city was protest?
I think it's...
It felt like that.
It not marching, but I would, when I on the way to, you know, the Barry Station where they set up every day, you see families in intersections banging pots and pans, the casseroles. And I'm thinking, you know, seeing tens of thousands of people on this march, it certainly feels like, you know, you walk down these streets in these neighborhoods, people are hanging out their windows banging pots and pans. But so I'm obviously I know the entire city wasn't protesting. It's
right.
Just you couldn't turn a corner without seeing someone participating in some way. I mean, not every house, but a lot. And the most interesting thing to me is the casseroles protest was a happy protest. You saw people dancing and laughing together as they bang the pots. Whereas, you know, here you're used to seeing people being aggressive. Not necessarily angry, but, you know, chanting something that they want to see changed. This was just friends and family out laughing and smiling and banging pots and pans, you know.
And did you have a sense of, I mean, so was that the biggest difference, I mean, from Occupy? Obviously, the amount of involvement by the broader community is different. The tenor of it, I mean, how much of that do you have a sense was cultural?
Yeah.
Much of what I've read suggests that the protest is far stronger amongst the French Canadian population.
That's what it felt like. My liaison was Anglophone, and what she told me was that you go to the English speaking areas and it's much less. So we actually went, we checked it out, and as you leave the French neighborhoods, it actually starts getting quieter, and you hear less of the casseroles being, you know, the pots and the pans, and it's great. It's weird to me, you know? Is it the language or just the culture that comes from, you know? But one thing that's really interesting is lack of cameras. Whenever I go to a protest in the States, cameras everywhere. You know, as soon as the police make an arrest, there's 25 to 30 cameras pointing at the scene. But with these marches in Montreal, almost no one is filming. At least relatively, because there's CUTV, they do a live stream. But when I was at home before I left, I'm like, how can I watch a live stream of this? And they were like, it's just CUTV and they're down right now. And I'm like, really?
Why do you think that is?
They're more likely to protest. I mean, another example that people in
do you think they have less of, do you think that's something that's, I mean, subject to change insofar as it seems to me that the cameras that have taken place, that a lot of the cameras, I should say, not all of them, the recording is done to capture any type of abuse by the police.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, I haven't been able to see the same reports of that type of abuse up in Canada.
There have been. There's rubber bullets, tear gas. Someone lost an eye, got shot. So I'm told by the locals that they traveled to, I'm not sure exactly where, It might have been Quebec City, and actually got shot in the head with a rubber bullet and died.
Oh, well, so why isn't there more people with video cameras there? I mean, did you ask people that question?
Why they weren't filming?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And no one really had a direct answer. They just kind of, you know, didn't really think about it, I guess. But, you know, what someone pointed out to me was when I brought it up, he said, everybody's wearing the red squares,
uh-huh.
but in America, everyone's putting red squares on their profile because Americans are passive. So it's easy to go out with a camera and point it and watch and do nothing. At least that's, you know, what this guy told me. I don't want to speak for everybody. As opposed to actually going out with the casseroles and banging it and taking part. So I think it's kind of the idea that we're here to do something. You know, they don't, I guess a lot of them don't see... Maybe it just could be because it hasn't been introduced, but I guess
also there's the issue of, like, who are they going to be? There's so many. One-third of the city is protesting. Who are they trying to reach at that point?
The world, you know? So after I marched with them for a while and I'm tweeting and I'm streaming a little bit, we decide to sit down and see just how long this is. And it took a half an hour for the march to pass us from the front to the back. And I say the march because that's where it was more densely packed. After half an hour, we're like, okay, the march is over. But still, people were coming up, maybe in the, you know, 5 or 10 people every so often, banging pots and pans. And I wasn't even there for the big marches, you know?
Wow. Amazing. Well, timcast.tv is the site. Tim Poole, thanks for joining us. Good.
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter. My handle is @TimCast.
@TimCast on Twitter as well. Thanks,
cool,
Tim.
Thanks.
I appreciate it. All right, folks. We're going to take another brief break, and then I will play you the interview with David Dan. I think I'm getting old. I can't see my iPad. I have to put, like, big, like, grandpa. Do they have one of those, like, magnifying things for my soundboard? And one of those magnifying things for iPads? Grandpa, I gotta get new glasses or something. All right, folks, we'll be back in just a minute. Gentlemen, still not getting to the David Dayan interview yet, and I'll tell you why. Because I have some I don't have my breaking news thing. Folks, you know, one of the great things about Netroots Nation, the first time I came when it was a yearly co's, is that I would meet people that have been talking to me on the IM for years. And it was always very strange because they would say hello and I would literally see the little window box, their nickname. Now, somebody just walked up to me, had a sign that said, "Hi, Sam," and he flipped it over. And I will tell you what it said in just a moment. But to a certain extent, this is a big news story because it's going to blow the lid off of a theory that many people have had. And gosh, I wish Kyle was here because Kyle would lose it. But ladies and gentlemen, live in the flesh, just walked by me. Where is Kyle? Somebody get Kyle, because he's not going to believe this. You don't have to call me on the phone. It's Jeremo. Jeremo, say hello.
Hello, Sam. So glad to meet you.
I can't believe it. You're not Eddie Pepitone.
No, I'm not.
Oh, my God. There's a lot of people who are going to be very disappointed about that. I'll tell you something. Right now, Matt is back in New York. He's listening to the show, and he is doubled over in shock that you're here.
Missed you, man. I wish you were here.
There you go. It's Jeremo. So, Jeremo, is this your first time out to Netroots Nation?
Yes, it is.
And what do you think? Matt, literally just IM'd me. Holy shite. He's gone crazy. And then 45 different exclamation points. So what brought you on here, Jeremo?
Well, you mentioned it the other day. And I looked it up, and I said, you know, I'd really like to go to this, but I have a problem getting off work. But I worked it out.
You did. Good job. Wow, that's.
I am enjoying it. Unbelievable. Matter of fact, Sam, I'm on overload. I got to sit down for a while because I'm going to be here for 2 days. Right. I hope I can make it.
Yeah, no, I hope
so
too. Because
there is so much information, and it's unbelievable.
There's a lot of great panels. What panels are you planning to attend?
Well, this morning I went to, you were there this morning, the first news broadcast.
Right.
And then I went to the Women's Media using networking and stuff, and that was excellent. I was maybe the only two guys in the meeting there. But
is that where you're going, Joe?
No, I thought it would be. It was about the elections and stuff. So I really, I said, I don't care. I want to be in there. I want to see what they're talking about. And the other one was Occupy Wall Street with. It was very involved with working with the political system
as an option.
That.
And yeah. Have you been a big blog reader or
no? Sam, all I have is you. Well, not really.
Well, I have to say, Jeremo.
I got my buddy Sam.
Hey, you gotta imagine you got a family, and I'm sure
there's a beautiful wife.
Okay. I'm sure. So yeah, we wouldn't want her to think that all you have is me.
Well, she was asking how you were before. She said, "Have you seen Sam?" I said, "Yeah, I saw him, but I wasn't able to talk to him." But the thing is that. I'm a nurse. I'm not political. I take care of sick people. And with everything going down in this country, I just decided I got to get involved. And after seeing you on Air America, you know, I think I told you one time. I said, Sam, you're smarter than Al Franken.
Well, I got to be honest with you. That's not the case. I mean, I know Al Franken.
Are you saying I didn't say that?
No, you may have said that. But I got to say, Al Franken is incredibly intelligent. And when he got into the Senate, he was immediately one of the top four or five most informed senators that were there, if not more.
Maybe effective. Because I listened to his show, too, but I always enjoyed your show. Always.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, his was a little bit, mine was a little younger and edgier.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what it is. So tell me, what's the rest of your plans, Jeremo?
Marista, I'm going to hang out tonight. I'm going to see maybe there's a party or something going on. Then I'm going to hang over, stay over. And then tomorrow I'm going to spend the day and check out things. The only thing with me is I'm not really computer, with software and stuff, figuring out what's available. And I'm kind of, I'm just doing it by the...
Looking at the book.
Yeah, just
looking
at the book.
You got one of these books,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's going well, but I am enjoying it, and I highly, highly recommend this.
Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, the fact that Kyle is not here, I think is going to be crushing to him. Because he's walking around here, and I think this is going to be...
Is there a possibility we could get a picture, just you and me?
Give it to Scott, and he'll take a picture while he's on.
Scott, you know how to work this?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, Jeremo, here. No, stay there, so I'm interviewing you.
All right.
You want to... come on, we'll be...
All right, here.
You're going to be in the picture. Take a picture where he's... Here, hold that.
Let me hold this, right.
Yeah, and now one...
You know, he's very serious.
Two, three... And Jeremo, this is when you're being interviewed live, Jeremo. Then you want to come around? We could do that. We'll get that picture here. No, you got to give me this back.
All right.
That's not a memento.
Maybe tomorrow.
He's holding my arm tomorrow. Okay.
But it's good to see you.
Well, Jeremo, thanks for stopping by. It was great to finally meet you in the flesh.
I want to say thank you for everything you give us.
Oh well, my pleasure. I'm a little bit disappointed you're not Ed Pepitone.
I'll be quiet now.
Okay. All right. No. Go, folks. All right, well, let's take another quick break, and we'll come back. We'll do that David Dayan interview forthwith. If I can actually do this, I'm going to play for you my interview with David Dayan from a little bit earlier this morning. Here it is, right now. Continuing our coverage of Netroots Nation 2012, it is a huge pleasure for me to welcome to the program David Dayan, who I think it was we first met. Well, no, we
no.
second met. We second met at it was probably Yearly Co's, right?
At the first one, yeah, in 2006.
You can step back from the mic.
I can
a little
step
bit.
Back.
Step
from
back
mic?
From the mic. Just be step back from the mic.
No, I wish I had headphones. I could do this. I could tell you
no,
off
you're
in my
sounding,
monitor.
You're
down.
Sounding great. No, okay. No, I know.
Yeah. In 2006 was the first event, and I've been to all seven.
Was it 2006 the first one or 2005?
2006.
Okay. All right. I can't
in
remember.
In Vegas, and you were at the in the luxury box.
That's right.
There was a very strange setup
there.
There
was no Radio
there.
Row.
There was no Radio Row. It was a radio box.
Yeah, we were...
You were like Bob Costas reporting from above.
Indeed. Indeed. And we were looking down upon the...
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about, in the context of, and I think, you know, my audience is very familiar with your work. Obviously, you've been on the show many times, and 90% of the time I'm talking about anything, it's because of something that you've reported on. And sometimes I tell them that, and sometimes I don't. Sometimes I just pretend like I did the
whatever.
Reporting. But, and of course, David blogs now at Fire Dog Lake News, and it's... does yeoman work? We've talked about this many times. So, but
news.firedoglake.com.
Just go to Fire Dog Lake and then hit the news.
You could do that too.
Who does all the dots? Now you first started
called
writing.
Bookmark.
You first started writing at Hullabaloo, right? Is that
well? First, I was at my own.
Oh, wait,
site,
no, right.
dday.blogspot.com, which is no longer active, but I still get ad money from it.
Nice. How do you work that?
Yeah, Digby Side and some other places around the blogosphere.
Right. Okay. So, all right. But let's talk about this. I want to talk about, I mean, obviously you're acutely aware of the failure of this administration in many respects, in all respects, to deal with a lot of the fraud in the finance that was involved in the financial crisis. The underlying problems of the financial crisis and providing support for homeowners. I want to talk about that a little bit, but I want to talk about how this place has changed, how Netroots has changed,
okay.
And how that ties into it. Give me your sense of how Netroots has changed over
sure.
the years.
Sure. The first Yearly Co's was, first of all, very daily Co's intensive, and second of all, it was very much about people who met online coming together and meeting. I think that this event has changed as online media has changed. Online media has become much more professionalized. The idea of the lone blogger getting a huge audience is not necessarily something that can happen today. And as that professionalization has taken place in the blogosphere, we've also seen that here. And this event now, you know, has a lot of similarities to sort of a trade show for progressive organizations. And, you know, has it gone away from its roots, or have the roots just sort of changed in many ways as the sort of changes in online media have gone on? I think it's probably the latter. But yet, despite that, I think it's hard to sort of talk largely, writ large, about a conference that has 2,000 people in it, because you can have the experience of, you know, just meeting grassroots folks and you know, the Occupy movement actually has a fairly big presence here this year. I think there's several panels at least, and so I don't want to make too many
broad generalizations. I mean, I wonder if there was a time in this in the sort of the trajectory of this that sort of also. That also mirrors what happened online. Like you say, there's another way to put it as opposed to professionalism. There's also whether or not it is has become more of the establishment than it. Much of what happened online was a response to being shut out of the conversation and developing And I guess maybe at that time it was harder to see, developing either a separate conversation or a separate platform to get into that conversation, or both. And because, I mean, I ask this, like, you know, for instance, tonight, Thursday night, Eric Schneiderman is doing the keynote speech.
It was funny because I was just at a panel that was about breaking up the banks, about going after the banks on a variety of issues. And the Schneiderman panel came up. There was someone in the audience who raised their hand and said, Schneider's doing a panel tonight. Why? And how should we respond to that? And basically the panel was almost universally negative towards the fact that was happening. So I think there's sort of two conversations going on. I think at one level you're absolutely right. It's the more... establishments entering into this conversation, and now it just being sort of this a progressive group trade show. But also, that isn't universal at the participant level,
right?
Where I think there is a lot of apathy and really kind of, you know, just a resistance.
Not necessarily apathy, but I think intense ambivalence
to that this kind of evolution that has gone on here. You know, and what's interesting is that as that has happened, less media is interested in this event because it's not really all that different from the, you know, what you get out of an establishment Democratic source. Also, the participant, I mean, you know, Schneiderman is probably one of the only new faces in terms of keynotes at this event. These are all people we've seen before.
Uh-huh.
I feel like there's been a ceiling reached at some level in terms of, you know, it's an election year, and there's not one member of the administration, member of the campaign at the presidential level here at all. And at least in a keynote aspect, I think Obama for America is here in some form or fashion. But it's interesting how it has been... You know, if you want to use the word co-opted, it has been simultaneously co-opted and marginalized.
Right.
You know,
in many respects, does that describe the entire broader
progressive
sort of,
movement?
Yeah.
There's no question about that. It's really interesting to, you know, draw those parallels because you do see it sort of in its physical form here, the frustration of some people of how this whole thing is spilling out and how progressives have been shunted aside in the Obama era. And you're kind of seeing it in real time when you're at this event.
Yes.
Like this.
I mean, because I got an email from Netroots Nation. Yeah, I'm on the email list, It was the man the banks are scared of or something like that. And it was an American prospect story of Eric Schneiderman. And, you know,
Harold Meyerson wrote that, and he's a terrific writer. But that was one of the worst stories I've ever seen.
Well, the timing was also really bad. Like, you know, that story would have worked
eight months ago,
9 months ago. Yeah. And, you know, it was very strange. I spoke to Bob Kuttner on my show after Schneiderman took this appointment, and he was assuring me the same thing that I think that you heard assurances and were reporting that you were hearing from other sectors. This guy, he's playing 11-dimensional chess. He's running circles around him. He's got a whole plan mapped out. I actually think that he believed. I mean, the 3 days after he takes that position, he goes on Chris Hayes' program and says, you know, mark my words, if you don't see activity in, I think he said 6 months or three months.
He did say
months,
6 months.
He laid down some marker that had me going, wow, that's right. Pretty, that takes some balls because this is going to happen before the election, and we're really going to, this isn't like.
And meanwhile, this week, Schneiderman headlined a large fundraiser in New York City for the president. Schneiderman's spokesman, his lead spokesman, Danny Kanner, is now a spokesman for the Obama campaign. The idea that this guy is so independent that he's somehow going to walk if he feels like the investigation isn't proceeding at his pace is ludicrous. I mean,
right. That's off the table.
He is now a part and parcel of the campaign, and he's not going to throw that away and remove himself from the president, causing a major shakeup and national headlines at this time. I mean, it's just clear that's not going to happen. Even though he sort of acknowledged that he wasn't getting the resources that he needed when he spoke to the Wall Street Journal a couple weeks ago and said, do we need more resources? Yes. You know, then he said, I'm confident we're going to get them, but I don't know why we
That's
are.
That's what he said five months ago.
Exactly. So it's you could see this coming if you had been, you know, deep into this stuff. Over the last several months, you could see the fact that just announcing the task force popped a balloon. There was pressure on the administration to do something, and a significant amount of that leverage.
Do you think Schneiderman got played? Do you think he got bought out? Do you think that he? I mean, I just find it hard to believe that this guy is stupid enough to go on TV 4 days later and put himself down and put down that definitive of a marker. That didn't sound to me like a guy. I think he got somewhat outsmarted and now he's going to plan B or C.
Yeah.
Or got bought. I mean,
you know, Max Berger, who was from Occupy Wall Street, was on when he talked about Schneiderman on the panel I just referred to, said that this is a nice guy that doesn't want to admit that he was played. And that's possible. Schneiderman is a political animal. You know, attorney general is a clear stepping stone. In New York, the last two attorneys general have become governors. So,
yes.
I mean, it's a political position. And, you know, so was Schneiderman doing the right political thing to ally with the dominant force in the Democratic Party in order to, you know, for career advance or whatever it is? Yeah, he probably was. He did put his reputation on the line in a very serious way. He is the man the banks fear.
That's the thing. I don't think that he went into this with that plan, because if he did, he's a very bad politician, which I don't think
he
is.
Well,
you don't go and you put that type of marker and you say, I'm sure we're going to be seeing activity soon. And, you know, you don't put a number.
What I've heard from high-level people is that it's very easy for politicians to believe their own headlines and to believe that their own power persuasion or power of argument or whatever leverage they personally perceive is enough to get the job done. And
who are they talking about? President Obama?
Yes, but also...
Don't worry, Schneiderman, this isn't 94, guys. You got me this time.
But the Schneiderman dynamic is very similar to the Obama dynamic. First of all, he got all these groups to believe in him.
Yeah.
Schneiderman did.
Yeah.
And believe in that the power of his thrust was enough to make this all happen. And I think Schneiderman bought into it as well. And you know, vanity is a trait in politicians, I think we can agree.
Yes,
and,
probably.
You know, sometimes you fly too close to the sun and you get your wings clipped.
Has anybody checked in with Bo Biden? Because Bo Biden seemed to be a little bit miffed. During those, like, that, it was like a two-week, three-week period on both ends of that commission and that deal, where he seemed to be, like, a little bit annoyed, particularly at Schneiderman. I noticed he made two or three appearances in a row where he would not mention his name. He mentioned Kamala Harris. He mentioned Martha Coakley. He mentioned Nevada and California, but he would not mention Schneiderman.
Yeah. I think that the general sense at that time was as soon as Schneiderman flipped and sort of went along with what was going to happen, that, as I said, the air popped out of the balloon.
Right. What's Bo going to say to his dad?
It wasn't that. It was that New York held a sort of a privileged position by virtue of some of the laws in the state of New York, by virtue of the fact that a lot of the securitizations happened in New York, even though some of them happened in Delaware. It's still, Delaware's a smaller state, for let's face it.
Right.
You know? And once that popped, it became much harder for any of these individual actors to continue to hold out. So I think what Harris did in California is she said, all right, well, we don't have the solidarity anymore, so I'm going to get the best deal I can for my state. And that's how she went about it. And I think Biden, to a certain extent, did as well. Now, you know, he still did sue MERS, but I'm told that court, the first hearing, did not go very well at all. Mm. And that, that case is in a lot of trouble, actually. Yeah, I think it was just, it was clear what happened to me. I mean, you had a very strong coalition saying no to this settlement, no to this promise of something new, no to giving up the leverage that you have. I mean, you had a HUD report that came out with the settlement. It was part of the settlement that looked at, I think it was J.P. Morgan Chase, and looked at a sample of 36 loan files. And of those 36 loan files, 35 of them, it was impossible to verify the actual amount owed. On 35 out of 36 loan files.
I don't know how to math with, but that's a very high percentage.
That is a high percentage. So, you know, this kind of leverage of total servicer abuse and all of the various elements of fraud, a lot of which I'm going to go into on a panel that I'm holding tomorrow morning here, you know, when you take that off the table and try to build a second table, which is what Schneiderman's office has talked about, where it's all about securitization and just this sort of more narrow thing, but something that was extremely important and did drive the crisis. But when you take all of this other stuff off the table and you move to the second table, why should I believe you at that point when you've taken all of this massive documented abuse?
Right. Also, the problem is that an investigation like that is not two tables.
Yeah.
There is a continuum.
Absolutely.
And that's the way that you attack an investigation like that. You begin to unravel
from the bottom.
And you can't approach it as if these two things are sequestered. You know, otherwise, Al Capone is probably vice president. And,
I mean, one thing I am a little bit heartened by is that some of the outside groups have learned a little from this. Like Campaign for a Fair Settlement has come out with polling data showing that swing states don't believe that Obama's gone after the banks and that they're less likely to vote you know, people who don't take on the banks. They've done protests out in front of Obama campaign events, including one at George Clooney's house that I attended. Not the Clooney House fundraiser, but the actual protest in front of it. You know, I think that there's some recognition after they really cheerled what Schneiderman was doing, that they got played as well. And that was a major mistake, on the part of the outside groups. They're trying to atone for it. It may be too late.
Right.
But I am at least encouraged that they're using whatever power they have left, even though it's greatly diminished because of their actions. They're trying to sort of restart this conversation a little bit, and that's a necessary step. I'll be interested to see the reception that Schneiderman gets tonight. I think it will be positive, because I think the sort of the bank coalition or the group of people at this event that know what's going on about the banks is pretty localized.
Uh-huh.
I think he will get a good reception tonight, and I think the words that he is saying will probably get an impressive response, even though they shouldn't.
Fair enough. David Dayan, of course, at news.firedogleak.com.
There you go.
Or just go to Firelog, firedogleak.com.
Click on the news.
Click on news. Thanks so much for joining
Thank
us.
You.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, sorry about that. How do I stop this now? Great. I don't know. Ladies and gentlemen, we are back, Sam Cedar, live at Netroots Nation 2012. And I haven't gotten all the guests that we wanted to get today, but they will stop by tomorrow, of course. Tomorrow on the program, Shannon Moore will be joining us. Cliff Schechter will be joining us. I'm hoping to talk to Marcy Wheeler and Amanda Marcutt. Supposed to be by. I wanted to make today an all-guy show. And so I told any female bloggers, like, stay away. That's Female Friday is the way I do it now. That's what I'm calling it. Female Friday and Cliff. That's how I'm going to refer to it. But, ladies and gentlemen, your loss is your gain. And by that I mean Kyle Shank, the technical guru, the man, the myth, the legend behind the infrastructure that is Majority.fm, is sitting here with me now. Also, let me just tell you, you can IM me at Majority.fm if you want to, or any of my IM handles. I'll take a couple IMs. In fact, I'll take some phone calls at 646-257-3920. If you are so inclined, I can fire this baby up and see if the phone system works out of my iPhone. But wait a second. Oh, Kyle. I'm sorry. I forgot you were sitting there.
Oh, the phone system will work. Don't worry.
Oh, no. Yeah, I have no doubt the phone system will work if I can get reception.
Yeah.
So, no, Kyle, tell me, this is your sixth year here?
Fourth. It's my fourth year.
Okay.
My fourth year of Netroots Nation. It's the only conference I go to every year. I don't go to anything else.
You don't go to any, like, internet guru?
No.
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 You're done with that.
No, I'm beyond it.
Now, you've created donateyouraccount.com/majorityfm. The rest of it,
yeah,
I don't know.
I created it for you, Sam.
Do you hear that, folks? Do you hear how you're breaking Kyle's heart when he says he created it for me, and then he sees, like, Citizen Radio or Blocking
James
It Up?
Is here.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy that you folks have not joined, donated, you know, a Facebook post a day, a tweet a day, or one a week, even.
Yeah, I wanted to find a way to passively and automatically and efficiently get Sam new listeners and spread the word about the show.
And now they're all letting you down, Kyle. How does that make you feel?
It makes me feel like I had a child, but I like the neighbor's kids.
I know,
you disappointed me.
I know exactly what that feels like.
Yeah.
Because I do have a child.
And the neighbor kids are nice.
And I do like the neighbor's kids. So. But you also, not only did you create donateyouraccount.com, which has been used by Occupy Wall Street and
the Obama campaign.
The Obama campaign. So you're playing both the inside-out game. You're more about the technology, but it's fascinating that both a bottom-up and sort of a top-down type of structure, they have found this to be an effective tool. Now you've developed, I mean, you've made a bunch of different things, like, but you've made, you've got a you want to tease this?
What was that?
I couldn't hear you over the roar of the crowd.
Do you want to tease your latest?
Yes, yes, yes. I want to tease this. That's what you said.
You know, one of the things that I have noticed about guys who are really good with technical stuff, socially they're awkward.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can't tell the expression on your face right now what that means to me. So, yeah, I created something called fans.fm, and it's not completely done yet, but the idea is to take what Sam does every day, doing a live show that gets broadcast live, that can take callers live over the phones, and that then produces an on-demand listenable version of the show via the website or via a podcast, and trying to bottle all that up into a single site to become a utility for people to create their own content in the easiest way possible.
Are you worried that as the bar to entry into internet radio, full-on talk radio gets lowered, that people will value me less?
I think we already have an example of this in Donate Your Account. I mean, I do it for you, and then other people seem to have even more success with it. Uh-huh. So, I mean, this is possible.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm lowering the bar.
Is that concern?
I'm raising your bar.
Does that concern you in any way?
Well, I think it challenges you, you know, and
right.
I like that.
Right. That's interesting. That's an interesting theory. Majority FM is the IM. If you care to IM with me, now would be the time. If you want to call, 646-257-3920. I've got another 10 minutes. And, you know, in the past, when I've been at Netroots Nation, we've been broadcasting in an area that was a little bit more accessible, so I thought more people would walk by, and I had a couple of people who were scheduled to come by, or turned out that they're going to have to come by tomorrow. So, you know, I've got Kyle here.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is the better half of the program anyways, so I want people to call in or IM, and, here's an IM. Matt, ask Kyle how he feels about Thunderclap using a variation of his DYA idea.
Yeah, so, I mean, thunderclap.it, which I think you would pronounce it thunderclap.it. It's an Italian, you know, .it is Italian, is for Italy, it's domain extension. It looks like a Kickstarter.
Are you trying to, what do you mean, why, what is that about?
What am I, I'm just explaining what it is.
Yeah, but why is it thunderclap.it?
I think they're trying to make it like a phrase.
Oh.
Thunderclap it.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. I mean, Donate Your
Account. You're talking a little disparagingly.
Donate Your Account has none of that pretense. I'll say that right now. I have no qualms about saying that. No pretense whatsoever. Donate Your Account.
This is interesting, folks, because Kyle is really actually on the forefront of building technology, and you get a glimpse into sort of the...
I'm competitive. Yeah,
it's
I'm
like,
not going to lie.
You're like the Marc Maron of internet, of web design, architecture.
I mean, soon I'll be basically saying I get no respect, but by not literally saying I get no respect, which is merit.
Wait, say that again.
I'm going to talk about how I'm not respected enough, but by not literally saying it. So that's like what we're doing right now. Like, Matt is, you know, putting this out there.
It's the humble brag. It's the opposite of a humble brag. It's like a humble complaint.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, so it seems like a Kickstarter. It has the exact interface of Kickstarter around a single tweet, which is a good idea for getting awareness out about something very, very specific. I like the idea. I mean, one of the reasons I created Donate Your Account the way I did was because I wanted it to be easy for people to kind of opt in and not have to come back every time you wanted that the Majority Report wanted to post something and have to confirm something.
Uh-huh.
And so I found utility in the automation of that process as opposed to the very explicit notion of people donating for every single message a campaign might want to send.
Right. How much longer will it take for them to just come up with the automated thunderclap?
Well, here's my ultimate trump card is that I'm adorable. First, And second, I'm like an individual developer. I have that quality. You can reach me, Kyle Shank on Twitter. You can follow me.
Yeah. You respond to anything that anybody says.
Yeah, exactly. But all the code is open source. And what I mean by that is Occupy Wall Street actually runs Donate Your Account on their own servers. So what I'm doing here is a little bit of 11-dimensional chess, to borrow your phrase you like, in that Donate Your Account is now out in the ether. The code is out there. As I continue to develop, the code is out there, and people can take it, modify it, and do what they will with it.
You are sort of an ideologue in terms of this open source stuff. Is that an accurate description?
I hate the notion, the pretense that comes with software development. And I think that...
No, hold on. Before I want to be serious for a second. People should understand that this is a sort of relevant in terms of, you know, what the future is going to look like. Kyle's a young guy. You're a pretty young guy, I mean, relative to me.
Yeah.
And you this ideological battle of open and closed systems is really is important. I haven't quite figured it all out yet.
Well, actually, I think there's an analogy in the open internet and protecting that net neutrality, and a closed internet where you have to pay a toll and you can't see everything you want to see. And you're somehow not equal. There are similarities in the arguments. So, the open web, the way that people don't like Apple's App Store, the way that people don't like that, how they don't have complete control. For me, there are similar kinds of arguments to be made about source code and rights.
Now, when you talk about that open app App Store, in other words, it's not nobody can put their stuff there, but you can get your own stuff onto an Apple computer, right?
Yeah, you can. But it is definitely something that. It is a closed system. You can't arbitrarily publish.
Aren't apps in the way that we access the web also restrictive in some way as well? I mean, it used to be that we would surf the web and we would find stuff by accident. Now we have a button on our phone or on an iPad or even on our computer now,
right,
which takes us directly to that application online, and it's more efficient.
But there are no links. I mean, the web, when I talk about the open web, it's a web browser. Any web browser will do. You can be linked from site to site. In the apps world, you're not linked from app to app. You're in a closed system where you have to be approved to get in. And if your app pisses somebody off, it may be taken away. And that's kind of the difference when it comes to that kind of thing. Net neutrality is a different story. It's network traffic and access and bandwidth. And for source code, for me, it's more... I've developed so much software for IBM. I've worked for IBM several times. I've worked for big companies. I work for clients. And the life of a software developer is kind of like you write, it'd be like writing novels that no one ever reads because no one ever gets to see them. They're not preserved in any way. And when that software project dies, everything just disappears. So I think for me, the notion of something being open source and fighting for that a little bit is from a creative place to publish what I develop, what I create. And the benefit of that is other people might join me in the process of developing that software, or at the very least, someone else might learn from it. Because I've learned so much from just open source code. I've learned a majority of my software education from reading other people's code rather than being schooled.
Interesting. And so what is it, when you look at their code, what is it that you...
Well, sometimes you just learn how to use...
Do you learn dynamics? When you're reading code, do you learn dynamics that you can apply to other things, or do you simply learn what you learn rote? Like, oh, this is how I do this. I can copy and paste this code.
Well, yeah, it's more like I want to do what someone else did in their application in my application. So I'm going to go read their application and find the part where they did that thing that I also want to do. And then I learn from that.
But I'm asking, by learn from it, do you like literally will copy-paste it more or less?
You can copy-paste it, or if it's open source, you're totally allowed to do that as long as you adhere to the license. Or you just see the way that they did something, and usually that's what you're looking for, the logic behind something. Once you get so far into programming, the languages and writing your own code doesn't matter. It's more how something is done.
I see. So it's I go from A to C... to L to R, and that's the logical sequence to achieve what I want to achieve.
Well, and there's huge benefits of open source. For example, and there's a way to make money off it, too. I mean, the phone system I wrote for Sam was the precursor to Fans FM. I wanted to test out writing. I did this because I wanted to learn how to write a phone system and write a call-in system. So I just gave myself that task. I solved it with open source solution. It's a solution called Asterix. And without that open source solution, without that code base, we wouldn't have been able to do that so cheaply and so quickly.
Right.
So there's huge benefit to be had. And my theory is that the open source thing is a way to establish yourself in the community of software development and also the community of users, to try to interact with them and build on that, build a reputation by releasing your code. You do get something in return. Even if it's not monetary, you get people respect your code, your work. And I've done that before with previous projects.
You have my undying admiration.
Oh, that's true.
And gratitude, frankly.
I'm very aware. Once that admiration and gratitude stops, the servers stop.
I know.
Everything stops.
Every night I try and regenerate it to keep those hamsters spinning over at the server.
Well, it's funny. I mean, we met, we told the story about how I got involved with Sam and starting the reboot of the show.
Actually, it was here.
Well, last year we talked about it.
Yes, but it was at
Netroot Station in Vegas where we met in an elevator and we started talking.
Yep.
And I met you actually the year before in Pittsburgh, and I said, hey, Sam, here's my card. If you want to launch a new show, I can help you out. And I gave you my card.
Oh, you know, I was horribly sick in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, probably.
No, but, I mean, literally, I think I had walking pneumonia.
Yeah, you didn't look good.
I was looking a little green, right?
But I was hoping Sam would launch a new show. Then, a year later, we ended up meeting again.
Right.
There you go.
Yeah, that's the thing. If I'm ever going to start a show, you have to tell me twice to do it.
But it also seems kind of weird when people walk up to you and say, oh, hey, I can help you do all this. And I actually could back it all up.
Right. It's very rare that somebody says, hey, you know that all that infrastructure that you've been thinking about that's too overwhelming? Here's my card. I can do that for you.
And I'll do it for free.
Yeah, that doesn't happen that often. But it took me like 2 or 3 times before I caught on to what was going on. Well, Kyle, again, seriously, my tremendous appreciation. Always nice to reconnect with you here. Folks, we got one IM I will read. Vincent says Kyle should go on Talking Left, which is at 2. All right, fair enough. And folks, tomorrow on the program we'll have a lot more people. A lot more interviews from here.
With women.
Maybe. We'll see. I think that's probably likely. All right, folks, see you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow.